Colorful.
Sinai.
Colorful.
And Patrick.
Colorful Radio.
Today's episode of the Voices of Windrush is dedicated to Amanda Beckles. Miss Beckles was a dedicated member of the Grenfell community. She struggled with symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder after the horrific fire which claimed the lives of 72 people in 2017. The Voices of Windrush and Colorful Radio would like to send our deepest condolences and prayers to the family and friends of the late Amanda Beckles. I'll now pass over to my co-host, Mr. Patrick Vernon, who has a tribute to Amanda.
I was really shocked to find out the news that a close friend of mine, Amanda Beckles, had died recently. She had taken her life in December of last year, but it's only very recently, with the coroner's inquest, which had an open verdict on her death. I'd known Amanda for several years, and she had worked in the field of housing and regeneration, working mainly in West London. Also, she lived in West London for many years in the kind of Notting Hill, Shepherd's Bush area. A couple of years ago, she decided to do a master's degree in urban planning and design because she felt passionately about how to improve the environment for the black community in Britain. And soon after she completed her master's degree, the situation in Grenfell occurred. She was very keen as a local activist and resident to work with other members of the community to ensure that not only do they have justice, but there'll be better planning of services and community facilities in the neighbourhood. So she started to organise a range of meetings, did community surveys, but felt very frustrated at times where she didn't get the kind of respect and support from local authority and other organisations on the ground. Although Amanda suffered from post-traumatic stress, she did have a long history of mental health and illness, and that's why I think our show today is really important about self-care and the importance of that. Also, she was a child of the Windrush. She was of Bayesian and Trinidadian background, and she's actually related to the Vice Chancellor of the West Indies, Sir Hilary Beckles, as well. So we want to dedicate the show to her, but more importantly, one thing we have to recognise as community activists, campaigners, self-care is important for all of us. Amanda has left a legacy, and we want to build on that legacy in contact with close friends who are exploring different ways to recognise Amanda's life in West London. One of her close friends is Sister Isis, who has recently written an article about the impact of suicide within the black community and what more we need to do to protect ourselves as well. So, rest in peace, Amanda. We will still fight for Grenfell and we will still fight for justice for the Windrush generation and the hostile environment.
Colorful Sinai and Patrick. Colorful Radio. Welcome to the Voices of Windrush with me, Sinai Flary, and my co-host, Mr. Patrick Vernon. Joining us in the studio today, we have David Weaver, who is the president of the British Association for Counselling and Psychotherapy. He's also a political and social commentator. We are also joined by Malcolm Phillips, who is an Afrocentric therapist who has played a key role in delivering counselling services for the victims of the Grenfell Tower fire and the black community for over 35 years.
It'd be good to get your take on the Windrush scandal from your perspective. Obviously, we're going to talk about the whole stuff around the impact around mental well-being, but you know, maybe let's start off with you, David. Mm-hmm. I've known you for many years. Yeah. You've been involved in so many things politically, and also you have this role as president, which is of a professional body for counselling and psychotherapists. But from a social commentator perspective, what do you see in the scandal?
Well, it's a scandal which has not been taken seriously by government or the party political establishment. It's not been taken seriously. I think it's been dragged, screaming and kicking by people like you, Patrick, if I dare say, into recognising the problem. It's gone through the parliamentary mechanisms and it's been identified as such. And, you know, others will say differently. But I think while some good work has been done to expose it and to drag it and expose it through the party political or the parliamentary process, what is happening now is probably worse than the scandal itself, because what is happening is that the government and the opposition are hiding behind Brexit, whilst the victims of the Windrush scandal are suffering. And they're suffering in silence. They're losing their dignity. Their mental welfare, mental health is being completely jeopardized on a catastrophic scale. And what we are seeing, and I have to say this, I think, are civil servants who are making a risk assessment that actually the political comeback is going to be minimal and that these people will die. And I can't put it any cruder than that. It is a disgrace.
Well, I think a lot of people feel that way. And it's one of the weird things because, of, you know, it's about, what, 15 months on. And what things have come to halt. You know, we're going to talk to Martin Ford a bit later about the compensation scheme, what's happening with that. But I know that you've been involved in the marches and demonstrations and you're part of various networks. What more needs to be done, you think, from the community perspective?
The community really needs to mobilise. And I think it's one thing pointing the finger at the establishments that I've just done. But also we need to point the fingers back at ourselves. The churches need to do it a lot more. So it's a natural home, I think, of this kind of an issue where you have that generation in the churches. I speak as the son of a minister in Nottingham, and I would say that they're taking action around this. They need to do more, and churches need to do more. We have, in communities up and down the country, a lot of concern about this issue. But I do feel that sometimes we are locked into egotistical, very male-centric politics, which is getting in the way of doing what our communities want us to do, which is just organise. And Malcolm will speak around some of the initiatives that can be done very naturally to get people engaged and involved in the conversations around lobbying your members of parliament, lobbying your councillors, taking civil disobedience, actually ensuring that things don't get done against us, which is now beginning to happen. They are closing elderly day centres up and down the country that have a specific focus on black communities. Nottingham, which is the place of mine, but that's what they're doing right now, a Labour authority. So I think there is something about us looking in and actually just doing some natural things, getting people together, having the conversations, working out what it is that we need to do, becoming a nuisance. We pay our rates, we pay our taxes. So yes, and you know, I don't want to monopolise that now, but I would want to go into some detail around some of the things that we could do more of, but also recognise some of the things that are happening and are happening well as well.
Sure. What about you, Malcolm? I've known you for many years and you've been involved. You work quietly away in terms of doing some real stuff in the community, and then you got involved in Grenfell because where you are currently working in the area. What was your reaction when you saw the whole Windrush scandal? Did you say, oh my God, is this like another Grenfell? What was your initial reaction?
It's funny, it didn't hit obviously like the trauma of the tower, a tragedy that happens overnight. But what it is, it's part of a wider pressure on the community, some of which David's alluded to, of an unbelonging of elements of the community, a marginalising and putting to one side people who have been central in the development of this country. There were many black organisations across the country. Back when we used to meet a great deal, I chaired a national network of black mental health organisations, and there were around 300. There were 42 in London alone. Now there are maybe, I doubt if it's in double figures across the country. They've systematically been closed down and put to one side, so that the things that sustained us in the face of tragedies like this, where we would come together and where we were able to organise, are no longer there. I just see over and over again with when these things come to fore in our community, that the structures that sustained us in the past, we really need to rebuild. And so a good deal of the work that I'm doing at the moment is rebuilding connections in the community from the ground up, from individuals and families, to trying to get communities to come together so we can be more resilient in facing these things.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned about there's a whole network of Black men's health organisations doing stuff. So just imagine if they were still around today, you think that would be a real powerful cushion, wouldn't it?
It would be a huge voice. It would be, back in the day, because we were so many voices representing tens of thousands of people across Britain, we had political voice. When things like this happened, we had to be heard. We had the ear of ministers. We lobbied hard for what we needed as communities. Mm-hmm. I think we need to start doing a great deal more of that. My work has been, over the last years, much more on the ground, actually dealing with the repercussions of these things.
And
what have you found?
I found that in the main, if we don't develop things for ourselves, the mainstream services are not adequate to deal with what we need. The experience in Grenfell was a salutary one. There was a human tragedy in the midst of the most wealthy borough, the best resourced borough in Britain, in Europe. And they were absolutely unable to meet the needs of the local community. That wasn't because they didn't have resources. That was because they don't understand us. They didn't understand, they had never engaged with the community that they were trying to help. And they didn't understand the rage that the community felt in again being put to one side, again being seen as though they don't count. Their basic needs are not taken care of when it comes to a scandal like this. It's just there's lip service shown to, yes, we care and we're going to provide some support, but the community aren't involved in delivering that support. And so the work that we did was very effective and central in helping people recover, because we sat alongside, because we understand our community, because we provided services in a way that they recognised and a way that they could engage with.
We'll touch on a bit later. Over to you, David. You represent, I don't know how many, tens of thousands of...
50,000.
50,000 psychologists, therapists in Britain and counsellors. What do you think is the response in terms of individuals, your members and your organisation to this? And what more do you think could be done around this, this kind of scandal, the tragedy, particularly from a mental health perspective?
Okay. If I'm blunt, the counselling professions has been caught flat-footed on this. So, as inadequate as the response was around Grenfell, at least there was some polarisation of thought around, actually, these people need some therapeutic input. It was fought for.
Yes,
but there was a realisation that that was the case, and Cruise Bereavement and other people like were brought in and providing expert support. And there were people who were feeling, actually, we're not getting what we need, and some dropped out. Mm-hmm. But in the national glare was that focal point, which said, and you had the chief fire person in London coming out and saying, these people, and even our staff, need therapeutic support. Mm-hmm. We've not had that with the Windrush scandal. Mm. You know, we talk as a profession about the mental health needs of older people.
Yeah.
But something so stark as this has come up. And so the counselling professions has been caught flat-footed and are still not engaging with government in the way that it was done with other tragedies, to say, we need to focus our attention now. Mm-hmm. It's a state of an emergency. So it hasn't happened. And so I'm part of the organisation, so I have to take some responsibility for that. And one of the things that I'm doing, as you're aware, Patrick, and I was speaking with the Association of Black Psychologists. Mm-hmm. Malcolm invited me to his conference. One thing that was awareness of is that we need to do for self. Mm-hmm. So in terms of black therapists, we've got to break down this whole notion of I'm a psychotherapist, so you're a counsellor, you're a psychologist, you're whatever, and really look at what is required and actually start doing that now. Mm-hmm. In terms of the counselling professions and BACP, mm-hmm. and it's something that I've been pushing really firmly, is there has to be firm engagement with government. There are black and white therapists within the association who realise we need to do something about it. Mm-hmm. The role of bodies like BACP, the role of entities like the Association of Black Psychologists and the black entities within BACP and people like yourselves, is how do we get together, lobby government so they do what is right, put resources what is right, NHS, do what is right at the same time as what is it that we can do next week Sunday to start addressing some of these issues in our communities. So, in short, not enough.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm not a trained therapist or counsellor, but I've worked in mental health as a kind of manager, policy person, campaigner. And I've got to know quite a few of the survivors of the scandal. I've got to know everyone a lot of them up and down the country. And I've used this label, I've written blogs about this, I've called it the hostile environment trauma.
Yeah.
Because people are traumatised, anxiety, depression, food deprivation, sleep deprivation, all the kind of things, all the symptomatic things which you would do in your initial counsel session.
There've been suicides, and
the question is this socially engineered by the government or not? Because of the whole creation of a hostile environment, and if it is socially engineered, do we need to have a new, like the work that Malcolm's been doing in Grenville, do we need to have, forget the mainstream, give us the money, employ black therapists and counsellors, and set alternative services, or is it trying to say, actually, CBT needs to be modified? I know, it's just a question. Malcolm.
I think one of the things that strikes me is that the community are in crisis and they don't know they're in crisis.
Yeah.
Many people aren't responding to Windrush because it's seen as being about these few people who were on that boat at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the repercussions of Windrush are affecting us all, affecting generations. And how it affects, there's a very obvious tragedy and a need for providing support for the survivors, those who have been directly impacted by this Windrush scandal, and then it's been devastating for their families, and they need support, and that has to be put in place. Mm. And it's not a small, simple, off the shelf CBT. Mm. It's individually what they need and their specific circumstances that has to be addressed and put in place for them. But wider, the impact that these hostile environments have for a community creates a levels of stress that ripple out across the community when you don't feel safe. This is basic psychology, that in order to be mentally well, we have to feel safe in our environment. And if you wonder, if I go on holiday, am I going to come back? Or is my family member going to disappear? And for how long? I don't know how you would deal with that. I recently went abroad. I don't know how long I would survive if I'd been told, actually, you can't come back, or maybe you've got to reapply, or you've got to wait. Would I survive 6 months? What would happen? My job would have gone. Mm. My financial situations, where would I be? Where would my children be? But that having in your head a sense of insecurity and safety, as you said, creates stress and anxiety that's unseen, that ripples out around the community. People don't even know that they're feeling this. Mm. And so one of the things that we've developed that is a world movement across African communities is the development of resilience, the groups that can be set up that don't cost a great deal of money.
Is that emancipation circles?
The emotional emancipation circles. Okay. They're actually free at the point of contact for black community. We've been setting them up in Birmingham and in London, but they're available. We're trying to roll out around the country where they can be delivered. We've recently trained around 50 facilitators to deliver these. And it allows us to come together as a community to understand the stresses that are impacting on us in our lives. The stresses from these hostile environments, these comments made by leaders about go back home, go back to where you come from. Yeah. We see these things on the news and it impacts our well-being. It's well known the impact of microaggressions on our mental health. So if we can develop these groups, if people can engage, can access them easily in the community, it builds resilience. You learn about how to manage stress and recognize stress in your life. And I think more than anything, that's what we should be doing rather than trying to turn around a community, or at the same time as trying to turn around services that don't understand us and haven't the capacity to actually deal with us. As David Say said, yeah. I firmly believe that we need to start looking after ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. I feel like trying to get these big services to understand our complex issues, our complex backgrounds and lives, we would be wasting crucial time when our elders and our community need that sort of support now.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Malcolm, how can Afrocentric therapies help people in our community?
Afrocentric therapies, it sounds something complicated. This is all therapies, every community in the world have healing therapy traditions. It happens that we as children of Africa, born and brought up in this country, are taught therapy. I trained as a therapist in this country and I studied psychology in this country. And we're trained to be good European therapists. We're trained to be very well versed with how Europeans see therapy. We're not trained to understand how it would be, how it would make sense to our grandparents, our foreparents, how it would make sense to in keeping with the values and beliefs of who we are. So it's not anything mysterious. It's just a healing approach, the normal therapies individually and group, but that are based on the values of African people.
Right. Okay. Patrick?
Yeah. So, David, what's your response in terms of what more can be done? You represent an important professional body. You do have ears to the government. Malcolm has given some suggestions about maybe emotional emancipation circles, doing things for ourselves. What can we do on a practical level? Because I suppose the question is, what happens if we do nothing at all? It means that in about 2 years' time, when the Mental Health Act Commission does its report, and then they realise there's a spike increase by 200% or more black people caught in the system.
Yeah. If we wait for the establishment, it's not going to happen. It's a state of emergency. Mm-hmm. So we have to be supporting the kind of initiatives that Malcolm has spoken about. Mm. And the role of BACP and bodies like that is to push that. Push that at local government level, at local NHS level, and actually at governmental level as well. But it's not going to happen if the lone voices at senior levels of the organisations do that individually. Yeah. You know, things don't happen unless there's a push from communities and from grassroots bodies to do that. So some of the work that you've been doing, some of the work that the National Black Lawyers against Windrush or for Windrush have been doing has to come together to push it at government. So I think we have to do for self, we have to do that now, but we can't let government off the hook, we can't let the NHS off the hook. You know, you've got to have more African-centred therapeutic approaches being funded by the NHS. It has to happen. Yeah, it has to be supported. So I think there is something about creating the kind of movement that Malcolm spoke about that used to be the case many, many years ago. We did have our ears to the politicians. So the amount of times where select committees meet, or there are committee structures that are meeting, and there's a lack of black faces within that. It didn't happen 25 years ago because we had a sort of political analysis as well around how we deal with these particular issues.
But could be argued that we've got more black MPs in Parliament, local government at all levels. Yeah. Surely we've got more than, say, 25 years ago.
But we all know that black faces in high places doesn't necessarily create change alone. We have to hold our black politicians to account. We also need to get more representation, but of people that are tied into an agenda for real change for our communities. P- people can make a judgment of my role as president of BACP. One thing I'm very, very clear about is that unless the agenda is about leading and collaborating with organisations, with other leaders, and being focused on change for our communities, it's a waste of time. That's why, for me, when we look at therapeutic approaches, it's got to be within a social justice, anti-racist context. It's got to be about that. It can't just be about the bits in the room with the people that we're working with. That is critical and important, but it's got to be about social change. So, you know, it's about collaborating, lobbying government, getting the right kind of representation, holding our black members of parliament and civil servants, the few that there are, to account as well, because they could be doing a lot more. But we have to look at our responsibilities as well, and demonstrate that which we say others should do, that we should be doing it ourselves too.
Absolutely. Now, David, there's been a special publication published in regards to the Windrush scandal and counselling. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Not much, no. to be honest with you, because I don't know which publication you're speaking about, other than to say that as a result of the review, counselling has been featured as something that needs to be an outcome of that. But that's not new. I think the point that I made right at the very beginning is that people know that, but there are no initiatives which are either looking at the long term or the immediate crisis that we have in dealing with the issue of the Windrush generation and their children, right, and the trauma, the wider trauma that's been faced with our communities. You know, all these pretty sounding reports that are being written are fine, and in many ways government know what to do. They talk about lessons to be learned and so forth. Divert the attention from lessons to be learned and put the focus into providing resources for dealing with the immediate issue and creating a framework for ensuring that this doesn't happen again.
What advice would you give to people who feel like, you know, mentally they can't cope anymore with the whole Windrush scandal, the pressure, the stress? They might have lost jobs, they might have been denied healthcare and benefits. What advice would you give to them in terms of their mental health? Where should they go for help?
So it depends on where they are. So where I am from in Nottingham, you do have good, strong community activity, which are telling people, no matter how you're feeling, just come and talk. So there are local surgeries that are taking place. There are a number of churches where people are going to. In fact, there's outreach work where people are going into those homes. Because a lot of those people feel they're isolated. Some of them, it's a sense of shame. A lot of them who I speak to feel they've done something wrong. I mean, it doesn't matter what you say now about go and speak to the Home Office when there's an interview, or go and speak to people. They actually feel that they've been criminals and something's going to happen to them. And the intensity of that emotion and stress, you know, cannot be underestimated. So when we say what we say, actually, you know, we need to be doing outreach and identifying who those people might be, and creating initiatives like the ones that Malcolm spoke about. And it's not just about, to me, it's not just about professionally qualified people. I think it's also about just people, just finding the time to talk. Churches, community organisations. I've identified six individuals who I've just made connections with, and in having the conversation and linking them up, they feel better. I didn't know this was happening. I didn't know there was any help. And it's that, you know. So I suppose, in a sense, I want to just take it down from the conceptual, professional conversation and bring it right down to what is it that you need to do this afternoon, this evening, tomorrow, in engaging those people that you even suspect there might be an issue with. And even if there's not an issue, a lot of our older people have isolated. You know, they're suffering from what a lot of older people suffer from, like dementia, Alzheimer's, confusion, so forth. We need to just demonstrate a level of respect for that generation because of the contribution they made for us.
Totally.
We just have to do that.
I'll bring in Patrick.
I suppose the question for Malcolm and yourself, David, is we've got the compensation scheme. It's got 12 heads where people can claim. And people can claim for mental distress and mental health problems. Do you think, how accessible do you think that's going to be? And what level of burden of proof do you think people need to prove to say, I've suffered from trauma, depression? Because and we're going to explore this a bit more with Martin, but from your perspective, what you know about the compensation scheme, do you think it can address those needs?
I think that's a difficult one. I don't want to preempt how that scheme is going to work and how it's going to make those assessments.
Yes.
I would hope that there would be a level of understanding in making those assessments that people are the best, are the experts in what their needs are. If somebody says, you know, I'm traumatized, I'm finding this difficult, there shouldn't be a high standard of proof that they have to provide before receiving some support.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I'm not sure if they're going to find it difficult. I would hope not. It depends who those heads and how that process goes.
What about you, David?
Yeah. I think Martin's had a difficult job, and the work that Martin has done in putting forward what the issues are and matched against what government says the Winchester scheme is all about, I think there's a dissonance. You can speak to him about it.
Yeah.
There should be a presumption that these people are suffering from stress. There's no presumption. Mm-hmm. There's no presumption from government. With Hillsborough, there's a presumption.
Yeah. Yes.
So there's not a presumption in this particular one. They should start from there. There's a lot of misinformation, and Martin will talk about that and give some clarity to that as to whether there's a maximum or minimum. Mm. There should be no maximum. You know, there should be no capping around this.
Yeah.
You know, when you dig deeper into those people that have been affected by it, it's much more than we even know now.
Mm.
Even when we think at our most traumatic level as to what it is, it's much more than it is to be now.
Yeah.
Government has a moral and a legal responsibility to properly compensate. And I'll tell you something else. Working in the capacity that I do is in BACP, and trying to work out how do you quantify this trauma anyway in the first place? Mm-hmm. How do you quantify this trauma anyway in the first place? It's very, very difficult to do. But if you're starting from a premise where you're saying, well, people with criminal records, how does that impact on the compensation scheme? You already begin to see the mindset of government, which is, actually, let's see how we can get away with stuff, rather than doing the moral and the legal thing, which is saying, let's start from really exploring what this is all about and ensuring that we compensate people in the right way. The fact that someone may come back and say, well, about the public purse, we don't have a limitless amount of money, in a sense, is not our responsibility to look at. It's about how do you do this thing and do this in a proper way. And I think part of that needs to be, and I think you made this point elsewhere, Patrick, is that you cannot have leadership from the Home Office in so doing. You can't have a situation where they're the perpetrators of the crime, continue to be the perpetrators of the crime, and then they play the leading role in determining how you compensate the victim. That's unethical, and it's not going to work.
Oh, it's been fascinating talking to you both. I've just realised we've run out of time. We could probably talk to you some more, but we've got some more guests to come in as well. Before you go, where can people get in touch with you online if they need advice? Malcolm?
I think the best place would be if they contacted the Association of Black Psychologists, UK chapter. They can do that at admin@psi.co.uk.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And for yourself,
and
David?
For me, if you contact me at the BACP, it would be david.weaver@bacp.co.uk. Funny enough, sometimes people say, I want to contact you, but I don't want to contact you at the BACP, which comes from one of the issues that we're speaking about.
Yes.
But if that is the case, you can contact me on david.weaver@dwcglobal.co.uk.
Thank you both so much for coming in.
Colourful.
Sinai colourful, and Patrick colourful, on Colourful Radio.
We are joined in the studio by Martin Ford QC, who is the advisor to the Government Compensation Scheme.
Hello, Martin. Welcome back again.
Thank you.
Great. So you came on the show right at the very beginning with Jacqueline, talked about a compensation scheme. We're actually looking at the whole issue around mental health and well-being, and it'd be good to get your take and perspective of how the scheme is going so far, and also particularly around the whole aspects around people claiming for emotional trauma or loss. What's the best way forward for people to what advice would you give?
Okay. If I deal with the first point first about how the scheme's going so far, there have been claims made already. Scheme opened on the 3rd of April. There's an issue, I think, around support and assistance for claimants. I'd be the first to acknowledge there's something like 13 different ways of claiming. For primary claimants, those are those immediately affected. There's also potential for close family members to claim. And unfortunately, where people are now deceased, there's a potential for their claims to be inherited. So there are three main areas. The Home Office have a bespoke contract with Citizens Advice, and the way to access them is you ring the task force number. They will pass on your details to Citizens Advice with your consent, obviously, and an appointment will then be made for them to walk you through the form over the phone or to meet them face to face. I've made it clear I need to monitor that because I need to know how effective that is, what kinds of people they've got conducting interviews and filling in forms, because they need to have a very compassionate approach, it seems to me. I think more promising than that, however, is that the Home Office have agreed that they will be launching a tender scheme for local communities to bid, or community organisations to bid for funding to assist. And I'm hoping that some of the groups that I've met in Nottingham and Manchester in particular, London's a bit more complex, but I understand the BCA may be interested in running clinics, and they will get funded by the Home Office to do that. And my thinking is that community are more likely to respond to being spoken to in a community setting with trusted individuals. That then means, and there was a discussion with the Home Office about this on Friday, that to launch in April and say the scheme is open for 2 years, before you have the community groups in place, seems to me to be a little unfair in terms of timing. So I'm trying to encourage them, and I think they're receptive to this, to have this two-year period run from the moment that the tender process is complete, and whether it be the churches or groups of activists or regional groups, that they're on stream. So I'd say from that point of view, so far, so good. Where I'm hugely disappointed, and I'm very happy to be given this opportunity, is in the response of the media and the trusted media. They continue to propagate misinformation. I've been in dialogue with The Guardian, The Independent, and The Andrew Marr Show, who have given people platforms, our trusted politicians, just to give misinformation. I think the most serious bit of misinformation has been that the overall cost of the scheme is capped at £200 million, which has found itself into the Jamaican press. Just not true. There is no cap on the overall cost of the scheme. And the Home Secretary said that in Parliament. So people have approached me and said, if it's 200 million and they're 15,000 claimants, that's 13,000 each. Therefore, there's no point claiming.
Oh.
And that is just not true. Everybody who has a claim will be paid, and there is no cap on the overall cost of the scheme. Other great myth, you only get £10,000 if you're deported. Not true.
Sorry to interrupt. I've actually read that in a newspaper.
It's in the Guardian. It was in the Guardian. It was stated on the Andrew Marr Show by David Lammy, who clearly hasn't read the scheme. It found itself onto the Labour Party website. They clearly haven't read the scheme either. And I just question their agenda. If they're going to put people off claiming, that will ironically reduce the exposure of the Home Office to compensation. And I want everybody to claim. If they have an issue with how their claims are calculated, then that may be the time to think about a legal challenge. And the Home Office are aware of that. And it's a work in progress. And if there are things that haven't been covered or levels of loss that people think are too low, get into a dialogue with me, the Home Office, other lawyers. Interestingly enough, when we went to consultation, most lawyers that responded to the consultation wanted bans or tariffs because it's a much simpler way of calculating losses. So the £10,000 for deportation is what you would be awarded by a court if you were deported. That's for the mere fact of deportation, mm-hmm. nothing else. Mm-hmm. So you could be deported on a Monday, wrongly brought back on a Tuesday, £10,000. Mm-hmm. Deported on a Monday, not brought back for 2 years, £10,000. But if in that 2 year period, because you couldn't get back, you lost 2 years loss of earnings, you get that in addition. If you were in receipt of benefits, you get the 2 years loss of benefits in addition. If when you come back, you find you've lost your social housing for the period of time that you are rendered homeless, you get the equivalent of the local authority tariff for the loss of your housing. If your family members supported you whilst you were overseas wrongly, financially, Western Union, we're all used to doing that sort of thing, or went on trips they otherwise wouldn't have gone on to visit you whilst you were languishing abroad, all those financial losses are in play and can be claimed by the close family members. If unfortunately you should have been here but you were deported and you have a claim but you passed away, that claim can be inherited by the executor of your estate. All three of those in parties, so the primary claimant, the close family member, and anybody who inherits, if they're also a close family member, would have a claim for their impact on family life. And that's the intangible bit, mm-hmm. which sort of neatly moves us to your mental yes. health question.
Sure, yeah. So. I mean, that's thanks for the update, Martin. I suppose because we look at the whole stuff around mental health, how easy is it for people to make a claim regarding stress, anxiety, depression, or trauma? We've just had conversations with a number of therapists and people representing the professional bodies to do counselling about that. You really have to understand the community to articulate that. Do you think that there's things in place to help people to articulate what is depression? You know, often we're very proud people, aren't we? So to say, right, I have suffered from depression or anxiety, and how they can then submit that as part of a claim.
Well, this was something that I think was recognised very early on, and it's quite interesting because, again, there have been very unfair criticisms of the scheme in terms of going to the law. The scheme actually provides for losses that the law doesn't recognise, and I'll give you a couple of examples. When this all came to light, beginning of 2018, end of 2017, I think Amber Rudd and Theresa May were on record as saying they wanted people compensated for the distress and anxiety caused by what they now term the compliant, formerly known as hostile environment. When I was appointed, I had very early conversations with the Home Office officials and said, this is very interesting because this is not a claim that the law recognises. The law will compensate you for recognised psychological or psychiatric injury. And there are bands of compensation in something called the Judicial Studies Board Guide to Compensation, which basically is something that's collated by senior lawyers, compensation lawyers, with judicial oversight, where they look at awards and they try to help judges be consistent in what they award for certain types of loss. So in my field, their tariffs for brain damage, their tariffs for people who aren't able to walk because of brain damage, their tariffs for orthopedic injuries, their tariffs for injury to the senses, loss of hearing, their tariffs for psychological and psychiatric injury. There's nothing for distress and anxiety because that's below psychological injury. So what the scheme decided, as the politicians had said, this is what they wanted to compensate for, was that we would mirror the tariffs for psychological and psychiatric injury. So you can suffer distress and anxiety short of a psychological injury and make a claim.
Right.
If, however, you have tipped over into recognisable psychological or psychiatric injury, you will find yourself subject to the same tariffs as if you went to court. So they exactly mirror them. I've made it clear to the Home Office that those court tariffs are often based upon likely recovery periods of something up to 2 years. And it may be that people have suffered for much longer than a two-year period, distress and anxiety or psychological or psychiatric injury. Obviously, some claims will be very well evidenced because people will have sought medical assistance, and so they'll be able to say, here's my GP record. Okay. I was prescribed amitriptyline for depression. However, I know, and I always cite my father in these circumstances, he thinks everything can be cured with ice and TCP, that we have a very stoical community. And certainly the elderly population see acknowledgement of mental suffering or illness as weakness. Mm. And so it's going to need to be teased out of them. I think the starting point has to be that if you are rejected by the country that you've paid tax and national insurance to, brought your children and grandchildren up in, to my mind, that must be very akin almost to suffering a bereavement. It must be a real shock to the system. And everybody reacts differently. But that's why I insisted that the close family members also have that claim. So I'll give you an example, another bit of misinformation. You don't get any compensation. The Independent gave Diana Abbott the platform to say for losing a university place. You do. And then if you were able to show that the loss of that university place had an impact upon your earning capacity, you would be able to get your loss of earnings. But more importantly, if the disappointment, distress and anxiety of being denied a place impacted upon you, which I almost certainly think it would, you get a claim for that non-financial loss under what's called impact on family life. That's the head of loss in the scheme. And more importantly, and this is something the court would never award, if your parents or close family members have witnessed your distress at being denied a place, and I, as a dad myself, I can imagine my elder two children who've both graduated now being devastated by not being able to take up a university place and it impacting upon me watching their suffering. Mm-hmm. So as their father, I would have a claim, and any other close family member would have a claim. Evidencing it is an issue, I accept. The scheme provides for the Home Office to appoint psychologists or psychiatrists to provide a report, as would happen in a court proceeding. You'd have an expert report. Now, having listened to the two gentlemen you've just been speaking to, and one of the joys of doing this sort of work with you is that you get the network established. It seems to me that if it's thought that there's a difficulty in teasing out this distress and anxiety or suffering from our community, as I said, they're quite stoical, or there may be cultural references that not everybody would pick up upon, that the Home Office probably need, in looking at their list of experts that they would want to report to back a claim of this sort, they may well need to start thinking very carefully about who's on that list and engaging people such as the two gentlemen you've just interviewed in assisting them with people who may have a particular cultural sensitivity. I mean, one of the reasons I'm very keen on the tender process is, knowing the communities I do, I think if you go off to see somebody at Citizens Advice you've never met before, you might well be quite reticent about getting into your mental health suffering. You might be very good on saying, I lost my earnings, I lost my home, I lost my benefits, I couldn't apply, couldn't get a bank account. That's all, in a way, pretty objective stuff. But how it made you feel is not something I think that members of the community will be very good at expressing to a complete stranger. Mm. They would express it to a family member, possibly to somebody from their church or somebody else from their community who was appropriately trained. So I do think there's a real role for having people who have that cultural sensitivity involved in this process.
So do you think that one of the things you might do is say to the Home Office, who's on your list? Is that list reflecting the community?
Yes, and I think maybe they need people to come into the Home Office and explain. I mean, I was just had a very brief conversation as they were leaving, and we've exchanged contact details. I not only think that it would be worth them getting into dialogue with the Home Office around that, but I am very concerned that you can have situations where experts are selected where you have protagonists in my field, we'll look at certain experts and say, they always say somebody who says they've suffered whiplash is a malingerer because they're employed by insurance companies. So you need, not just a list, you need real balance, real balance here. And I think that that is something that needs to be worked upon. And I'm also concerned that people should feel comfortable in expressing themselves in terms of how they feel. And this maybe can't be done through a very short process. I've been talking to community leaders who say quite often it takes them 2 or 3 meetings before people really open up. And you don't want a psychiatrist sitting there or psychologist with their, you know, looking at their watch because you've only got a half hour appointment. If in fact, as is so often the case, it's only the last 10 minutes of an hour long conversation that people actually answer the question, have you suffered? How do you feel?
Yeah. What sort of evidence would, say I was going to make a claim, what sort of evidence would I need to submit to support that I was suffering, say, from depression due to the Windrush scandal to make a claim?
The form, which again I think has been somewhat unjustly criticised because the first 3 pages are no more complicated than an application for council tax, gives a generous amount of space, and you can add pages to people simply describing how it's impacted upon them. And it might be that they can't put that into a psychological or psychiatric context. They might just say, you know, I cried myself to sleep, or I found I was getting palpitations. I felt constantly nauseous. Every time there was a knock on the door, I was worried about whether I was going to be deported. But as long as that's expressed, what I was trying to find out from the health professionals you were talking to earlier was, how would one categorise that as a psychological or psychiatric injury? Is it akin to a bereavement, for instance? Would that be a way of looking at it? You've been rejected by the company, the country you've lived in for 40 years, paid tax, paid national insurance, brought up your children. It's definitely traumatic, it seems to me. And the other reason why I wanted to include close family members having a claim, I've met a father and a daughter. Father was reporting on immigration bail. And every time he went to report, his daughter was concerned about whether he would reappear or be deported. And he's far more stoical about that experience than she. She's much more traumatized at the idea that she may well have had somebody knock on the window of a car and say, I'm sorry, he's off to Heathrow to be flown back to Jamaica. And then breaking that to her children, his grandchildren were very close to their grandfather. And again, in theory, they would have a claim if they were worried about whether granddad was coming back every time he reported. But I think it's very important to get as much of that narrative down, and then people can begin to assess it, and then they can assess whether they need expert assistance. Because I think if people have got a lot to say about that side of things, I would hope the Home Office would say, we need this person to be seen by a health professional, and they will tell us whether this is an adjustment disorder, whether it has resolved, whether or not it's ongoing, whether people have flashbacks, whether their GP records reveal that they were going in and saying to their GP, I'm feeling depressed, you know, I've lost interest in life, I've lost my appetite, but I suspect a lot of them wouldn't have said, and it's because I'm worried about being deported. So you're going to have to look at the time continuum and say, well, did they begin to go to their GP within a month or two of losing their job? Because then you would be able to show a link between how Windrush affected them and their condition as outlined in the GP report. We also know there are going to be some people who have more vulnerability than others. So there may be people, and this is really concerns me, who were already struggling with their mental health and then being affected by the policies around the Windrush scandal sort of tipped them over the edge. And I'm really concerned that we reach those people. For all I know, there are people who are in mental health institutions and properly examined, they are there because of their Windrush scandal experiences. So it's going to take a lot of hard work and a decent infrastructure to discover these people. But I still feel that the message I want to send, I think there are two. One, please apply, tell your story, and then you will be made an offer. If you're not happy with it, you can have an internal review. if you're not happy with that internal review, you might give more evidence, or they might ask you for more evidence. There's then an external review. I met the lady who's doing the external reviews. That's entirely independent of the Home Office. And we've already had a dialogue, and I've said, look, you may need to be very light touch on things like mitigation of loss. In other words, what do they do to sort their situation out? Because some people were so traumatized, they effectively froze. And you need to be very light touch on documentation, not least because things happened to people years ago at a time when there wasn't a compensation scheme. So why would they have kept documentation in the hope and expectation there might be one? And so it seems to me that the Home Office are going to have to get used to taking a lot of things on trust, which I'm not sure is the way they're used to operating. But certainly around compensation, I've sent them a very, very clear message that, you know, their starting point has to be these are honest and genuine claims until proven otherwise.
Yeah.
So do you think there is a degree of empathy now in the Home Office?
I've always found that the civil servants that I've dealt with are pretty empathetic. I mean, they run into some firestorms in public meetings, and I feel a little sorry for those that weren't even born at the time of the passing of the 1971 Act, which arguably was when all this started. I think the real problem for the civil servants is that the politicians come up with these ideas and make these promises, you know, we'll resolve your status within 2 weeks. And then they throw it at the civil servants. Mm. And they've got to try and devise an infrastructure. So on Friday, it's very interesting, I met the operations manager around the compensation scheme. He is advertising for up to 90 caseworkers, and he's got 41 so far, that he thinks are experts in compensation, to come and work as caseworkers. And he wants them to be people who can engage in a dialogue with people making claims. So I've said, I need you to employ people. If somebody says, I lost my job, you don't just say, how long did you work for? How much were you earning? 3 years at 15,000 years, £45,000. You then have to say, and did that have an impact upon your family life? Well, yes, because it meant that I couldn't provide for my children, or I couldn't afford to help them pay for this or pay for that. And my wife could see how upset I was, so it had an impact upon her mental health. They need to ask those supplementary questions and be empathetic. They've had to find offices for these people, phone lines, an IT support system, desks. But when politicians say we're setting up a scheme, they don't then think about the logistics. They then will, of course, be hammered in Parliament by the opposition. This is all taking too long. You're dragging your feet. Which I don't think is necessarily entirely fair. And I'm really concerned that although the suffering of people is being recognised on both sides of the House, that one of the issues for me is that people are expressing strong views on the scheme who clearly have not read it and do not understand it. And as I said, the irony of that will be that the Home Office will end up not being as culpable in financial terms as they should be. And then the second message is really about fear. I'm aware that people feel if they engage with the task force to regularise their status or they make a claim, that it could end up in some kind of sanction. In other words, if there's some flaw in their story, they could find themselves on the next plane. And I have an absolute assurance from the Home Office and from Sajid Javid himself, that nothing that goes to the task force or is involved in compensation will find its way to immigration enforcement. Now, some people will say that's not an assurance worth having because of the way the Home Office have behaved historically. And there's a massive trust deficit, clearly, between the community and the Home Office. But I really don't want people to be dissuaded from regularising their position and making claims because of a fear that it would lead to some kind of action against them.
Yeah. Well, it's great that you're there, Martin. How long are you tend to be at the Home Office to advise them? It sounds to me that you still have to steer or influence.
Well, what I've been asked to do, so in a sense, the scheme is devised. I've always said it was a work in progress, and there are new and novel claims all the time, and they'll come and ask me that we've not had one like this, or somebody suggesting that. A lady who said she couldn't marry her unfortunately now deceased long-term partner, and they have two children, was when he passed away unable to claim a bereavement grant. I think it's about £3,000. Mm. And I've said to the Home Office, you stopped them marrying because you wrongly questioned his status. She would have been entitled to this grant. She must be paid the grant. And they have agreed. So I've got a very kind of light touch overseeing role. And there is has been a board set up to oversee the implementation. I'm happy. I'm unhappy with the way the scheme's been represented in the media. And I'm frustrated by the fact that only programmes like this allow me to explain it fully. I'm happy with the scheme. I need to be very, very eagle-eyed on implementation and people's experiences. Mm. Because if it doesn't work the way I'm expecting it to work, then I will have no problem with people bringing a legal challenge. Sure. The Home Office have got to implement it in a very fair and accessible way.
It's been absolutely fascinating having you in again, Martin.
Thank you for having me.
To provide some much needed clarity on the compensation scheme. Thank you for clearing up so much misconceptions. We will definitely have to have him in again, I think, Patrick.
We might have to get someone from the Home Office. I think it'd be quite good to...
Yes, of course.
I think there's an opportunity for them, you know... Obviously, you're an advisor, but it'd be quite good to get the operations director to explain how it's working operationally.
Yep, more than happy to do that. As I said, they seem to me to be working quite hard.
Thank you so much. That was Martin Ford, QC.
Colourful Sinai and Patrick on Colourful Radio.
That edition of the Voices of Windrush was dedicated to the late Amanda Beckles.
Colourful Sinai and Patrick on Colourful Radio.